Rick M. DCM is from 13A. I don't know Rick. I know he's a really nice guy. I know he's articulate. I've heard him at a bunch of meetings. I do believe he does a lot of service work. I think he is a trusted servant. And I'd like to introduce Rick to you all. Thanks.
My name's Rick McNamara. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to, first of all, can you hear me okay, or am I echoing? Okay. I was listening to this thing before, and I thought it's got a mind of its own. First of all, I'd like to thank Rebecca for asking me to share tonight and to have this honor and privilege in front of what I view as the largest pocket of enthusiasm in Georgia. All the meetings I go to, whether it's my home group, whether it's the zone meeting, whatever, it all builds up to me to this weekend in Macon. And I always say, you know, when people say, what do you do down there in Macon? Yeah, they do nothing but scream and holler. And I go, you know what? I'm going to keep that the best kept secret in Georgia, that I absolutely love coming down here and being a part of what we're all doing down here. And for that, I'm very, very thankful. I guess I should tell you a few things. My sponsor tells me that, you know what, you got to get up there and you got to tell them what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And that's what you got to do when they ask you to do that. In a general way, Rick. I've heard your fifth step. They don't want to hear that. And some things that are very important to me when I do that are, number one, I have a sobriety date. And that's November 1st, 1994. Number two, I have a home group. And it's There Is a Solution in Roswell, Georgia. And number three, I have a sponsor, and I sponsor men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And those three things to me are very important today. Now, you all, you know, I knew I was in the right place this morning when I pulled in. I said, okay, they've asked me to come down. I'm the DCM for 13A. That's my responsibility. And shout out there. But I knew I was in the right place at the right time when I saw Unload Your Guns right here. And I thought, oh man, Tom's really got them riled up for tomorrow. Unload Your Guns right here. And I thought, oh shoot, I'm in the right place. And I heard a lot of good jokes, you know, at passing the basket and all that. And I've always heard, you know, it'd be good to kind of break the ice and tell a joke. And I got to tell you that I was born and brought up in New England. I was raised on a little dairy farm, about 35 head of cattle. And every morning we'd go out to the barn and we always had the AM radio station on and you give the farm report. But there were these two guys in Vermont that had this show, and I don't know if any of you have heard of this before, it's been years, but it was called Bert and I. And it was this comic relief that Bert and I could just picture these two guys in bib overalls just down there on the farm, you know, having a good time, but they would talk about all their escapades. And the one that I remember the best that I think applies to us was this one where they go to the big city. Clear my voice, because I'm going to try to put the New England accent in here when I do this. But it's been years since I've been up there, and I've traveled all over the place. I totally lost it. But I'll try my best, and it's Bert and I. So, Bert and I, we took a trip we did down to the city. And we traveled a long time down to the city. And when we got there, we was parched. We needed a drink. So we pulled up to the first bar, and we went inside that bar, and we sat down at the bar, and we said, "Barkeep, give us a drink of gin." And that barkeep, he looked at us, and he said, "Boys, in these parts, we got three kinds of gin. We got hydrogen, we got nitrogen, and we got oxygen." Well, I looked at Bert, and he looked at me, and I said, "Bartender, where we come from, we got three kinds of turds. We got mustard, we got custard, and we got you. Now give us a drink of gin." And I always liked that one. You know, I thought that is perfect for, you know, that kind of the dry sense of humor. So I grew up in New England. Came from a family of nine. I can't even imagine that today. Nine. I had four. And it was a parade every time we went somewhere for dinner. You know? It was like everybody's got to get seated and all that. Nine of us. And it was never, never a dull moment. I mean, stories that can... I got married in AA almost 15 years ago. Remarried, I should say. And I'll tell you that as part of my story. But anyway, my poor wife, Joan, I took her. We had been married like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And I took her to Washington, D.C. to meet the family. And she met all nine of them with their kids and all of that. And I was just like, holy crap. And they started roasting me at dinner. And, "Oh, Joan, you should have seen what he did. Oh, he would do this, he would do that." And, you know, it was the truth, but I'd say, "They're lying." And what I did was I had the forethought that they were going to do that. And I was stationed in Germany in the Army for 3 years. Back in the early 70s, and I was the oldest son, third oldest in the family. So I had all my brothers and sisters writing letters to me when I was over there. Well, I brought those letters with me. So I sat at the end of the table reading their letters back. Every time a story came at me, I'd start reading the letters back at them, and that quieted them down for a while. It was pretty funny. But my dad passed away in 84. He was 14 years sober, admittedly an alcoholic. He was in the bar business, and that's a part of my story. I was a bartender for a while. But I always say, people say, "What was your first drink?" You know, and they talk about the first drink, and I can remember nine kids. Business for yourself, who's got insurance? There's no insurance. And I can remember the toothaches coming, the shot glass. I see a lot of heads going, mm-hmm. The shot glass comes out and they say, "Okay, you know, rinse this around it, you know." And I remember rinsing it around my tooth and spitting it out and going, "Jesus, how could..." And I used to watch my dad. He was one of these guys that would take a water glass and fill that up with that stuff and drink it. And I thought, how the hell can he do that? And here I am, oh, Jesus, spitting it out. But the thing that I always say when they say, well, you know, what about your first drink, is I remember the first blackout. That sounds weird. I remember the first blackout. But I was 16 years old. I was up in the Green Mountain State, and it was my birthday, and some of my friends said, oh, man, let's go up on the mountaintop. We'll bring a bottle up there. We'll look down on the town, and we'll have a ball. There we went. Went up on top of the mountain. I remember about 15 or 20 minutes of passing that bottle of vodka back and forth. And as so often happened, the next thing that I remember is coming to. You know, in the bushes. The leaves stuck to the face. What is that? And first, you know, I don't know, maybe it didn't happen this way, but it seemed like the rest of them all came to at the same time. And they're all coming to, and I'm like, wow, where the hell? Rick, what a great time we had last night. Holy crap, wasn't that great? We broke into that hunting lodge. We cooked up that Canadian bacon. We drank that dandelion wine. You were a riot. The last thing I remember was looking down on the town drinking that vodka. That's it. I don't know what they're talking about. To this day, I don't even know where that hunting lodge was they were talking. I had no idea. Somehow we wound up back at the top of that mountain. But that, to me, you know, prior to that, I had done some beer, some Boone's Farm apple wine, and, you know, but this was celebrate your birthday. And now I'm like, holy crap. Now, the non-alcoholic would have said, holy crap, I am not, that's it. And I've had friends that have done things like that, and they just went, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore. But I kept going. I did like it. I knew it wasn't right, but that, I believe, the alcoholism was there already, that little, obsession. I like this. And my story, my experience is this, that, you know, I said, I gotta have this. Oh my God, I gotta have this. And I'll say this now, that later, at the end of my story, I said, I have to have this. I have to have this. And I always say it like this. Then I heard it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't remember who said it, but it's the alky-meter. Have you ever heard that? It starts over here with fun. Fun with problems. Problems. 16, I was, you know, bloop, there goes the meter. It's starting to pop up there with problems. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I continued through high school. I did pretty good in high school. I played sports, all of that. And I got a scholarship from the University of Vermont to go play soccer for them. I, of course, drinking the way I was drinking, and I liked to drink. I was drinking with the upperclassmen, and a lot of them were going to some different colleges. And there was one in particular where a lot of my friends were going to. That's where I wanted to go. That's where I wanted to go. I didn't take up that scholarship. I worked that summer, got enough money together to go to this other college, and I can tell you right now, that I don't remember where the hell any of my classes were. No, I can tell you about some of the gin joints that were there. They were great. But come the end of that semester, it was like, you're out of here. And I'll never forget, my dad was the old school. He said, well, if you're not going to go to college, and that's right, this is around Vietnam, my number was up, and my dad was in Connecticut, I was in Vermont, and he wanted me to come down there, so I had to shift my draft board down there. So I went, like everybody did, to the post office to shift my draft board down there, and I told the guy, I said, well, I'm due to go to Concord, New Hampshire for my physical. Do you want me to go to New Haven, Connecticut, or what? What do I do here? And he goes, give me your address and we'll notify you. I never heard another word. I gave him my address. But anyway, I got out of that, and my dad said, you're coming to work for me. I need somebody to tend bar. Damn, I got to do that. And 18 years old, the age was 18 to drink in Connecticut at the time. And they had a real, it was a hole in the wall, but it fed 9 kids. And I started off as a daytime bartender. And I remember going down in the morning and helping them clean up, and then, you know, I'd be behind the bar. And the bar opened at 9 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it was full. It was full. The post office was right next door. A lot of mail bags up lined up against the wall. And everybody had a mop leaning next to them at the bar, or a broom. And I thought, geez, first thing in the morning, huh? And I graduated from daytime bartender to nighttime. It was quite a promotion. At least in my mind it was. And by the time I was 19, maybe 19 and a half, and this is where, for me, I really crossed the line. I was drinking in the morning. I had an event where I had a night off on a Saturday night. And I don't ever do this. I don't know how many of you did this when you were drinking in a bar, but the places that I drank, I always had my back against the wall so that I could look out and see what the hell was going on. But this night, I was drinking that damn vodka again. It's like the big book says, you know, I got to switch my drinks, and I tried that. But anyway, I'm drinking that vodka, and I'm looking at this guy in the mirror. Nice-looking guy, I'm thinking, you know, now I'm sitting at the bar, and all of a sudden, World War III breaks out behind me. And I'm like, oh, no, that's it. The motorcycle club, the Huns would come in town. The branded ones were an offshoot. They were always fighting in the bar and carrying on, but it always got nasty with the bar stools flying and all that. And that's what was going on behind me. I could see it in the mirror. And I went, oh, shit. We had a 48-foot-long bar, and I knew where all the weapons were in that bar. And I just happened to be sitting in front of the beer cooler with the M1 carbine that was leaning against it on the other side of the bar. And over the bar I went. I grabbed the M1 carbine, and I had used that thing before, and I let a round into the chamber, 14 more to go. I have no idea who the hell I was going to shoot. No idea. And I'm ready to rock and roll. And luckily, the guys that I had been working with got that thing away from me. But here's my point. Is the next morning, I was back in the bar, taking the hair of the dog that bit me. Now I'm drinking in the morning. And there are people there in the morning doing the same thing I'm doing, but they remember the night before. And they're telling me what I did the night before. Now I'm about 19 and a half years old. And I just said, just what the big book tells us, right? I said, damn that vodka. You know what? Give me a Kluwer milk. I'm going to start drinking that. That's what's doing it. I got to quit drinking this damn vodka. Every time I drink that stuff, that this kind of stuff happens. So this goes on for about 4 or 5 years. I'm tenant bar. I think it was like 22. I finally decided, you know what? I'm going in the Army. That's what I'm going to do. Do something with my life. I'm going in the Army. So I go in the Army. And I get shipped over to Germany. And I do pretty well in the Army, but I am still drinking in the morning and drinking around the clock. And they found out that I was a bartender. And they said, we got an opening in the NCO club. We need somebody to tend bar. So now I'm getting all these checks, and I'm able to tend bar. I'm able to get all these drinks. And I got in trouble. Those of you that have been in the military, you know, Article 15s or something like that, for not showing up in the morning or, you know. And I was in Germany, so you got to ask the question. You know, did you go to the big beer fest down in Munich? I went down there every year. 3 years running. And here's another blackout moment. I take the train down to Munich. It's a good 300 miles from my post. About 8 or 9 or 10 of those liter beers, and I'm in a cab telling the cab driver, take me to Rhineland Concern. This guy takes off. And to me, I told him Rhineland Concern. He's going south. This I didn't find out till I came out of the blackout. And we're like 50 miles south of Munich. I'm north. And I'm looking at the guy. I'm like, I came too. I'm like, what the hell happened? Where are we? What are we doing? He doesn't speak any English. I'm not speaking any German. The next thing you know, the Polizei are there. And they haul my butt back up to Munich. Just another case of, you know, drinking to blackout. Coming out, you know, of the blackout, they dropped me off at the train station. It's like, I don't know, 4 o'clock in the morning. I get on the train. This is the beauty of it. I get on the train. Here comes the guy with the beer cart. I think I still got a few marks here. And I'm off to the races again. Anyway, what happens to me next is I get shipped back stateside. And I meet my now former wife. She picks me up in a bar, go figure. I got 2 weeks home. I meet her like day two, I'm home. I spend almost the 2 weeks with her. I get stationed from the East Coast to the West Coast. We're conversing back and forth by letter. She comes out in June. The end of June, we roll some pennies, and we're married. And she has 2 children from a previous marriage. Well, it got to be maybe 30 days into that, and she said, I have never seen anybody drink beer with their Wheaties. What is with that?
That's an Army thing. We're tough. That's what we do.
And I come home one morning, taking the hair of the dog. It's like 10:30 in the morning, and that's where I got the "it's the booze or it's me." You got to choose one or the other. And this is important, you know, in my experience, in my story. Here's what happened. I said, okay, I'll quit for you. Now, I'm about 26 now, 27, and I've been you know, drinking like that. I have no clue how to stay sober, first of all, and then secondly, to deal with life. I mean, if you looked at me and there was something going on with Rick where, you know, I didn't like it, I was like a thermometer. You know, I'd start getting red and it would just keep going up like this and I would just, I'd go off. I mean, now we got the kids and, you know, every summer we'd go up to Maine. We're living in New York now. And we take the trip to Maine. I do the alcoholic thing. I'm trying to stop drinking now, right? But I'm still acting like an alcoholic. I'm taking a trip to Maine 13 hours and I'm leaving after work on a Friday night. 13 hours. What the hell is wrong with you? But I'm driving up outside of Albany one night. And by the time I get up outside of Albany from where I was, you know, the car is a station wagon and it looks like Chevy Chase's Summer Vacation. Now we're driving along, the car's full, the kids are in the back with all their friends, and there's nobody on the highway up outside of 90 in Albany. And I'm driving and everybody's sleeping. And I'm like, damn. And I look in my rearview mirror and here comes a set of headlights. I'm like, hey, there's somebody else on the highway. And this car comes up behind me. Then it pulls up alongside of me. And I kind of look over. I don't know. It's an old Chevette or something like that. And the guy pulls up, and he pulls in front of me, and he slams his brakes on. And I'm like, whoa, wake me up. And he goes back behind me. I go around, and here he comes again, pulling up beside me. I go, no, he is not going to do this again. Sure as shooting. He pulls in front of me, slams his brakes on. I'm like, what the hell? I'm in six lanes here, and this guy's zeroed in on me. Now I'm thinking I'm going to bust every piece of glass out of his car. I'm starting to get riled up. The car, you know, my two-year-old daughter is asleep next to me in the front. The former wife is leaning against the door jam on the other side. My son's in the back with his best friend. They're sitting back there asleep. Here comes this guy again. Now, I got the electric window controls over here. And he pulls up next to me, and I roll the window down over here, and now he comes right up beside me, and his window is down. Excuse me, but I go, asshole, you got a problem? Just like that. And his car goes flying back. Everybody in the car comes to like this. My son's friend said, did you hear what he called your mother? I'm like, oh, shit. This is how I was. I mean, I was crazy doing stuff. I had no clue. The only thing I know about AA at the time was from tending bar in this little hole-in-the-wall place where guys would come in and they would say, Rick, give me a shot and a beer, save my place, I'll be back in an hour. And this is on my day shift, right? The first time that happened to me, I went, well, where the hell are you going? I got an AA meeting down the street. The judge told me I have to go to this thing. Just save my spot, have another beer and a shot waiting. I'll be back in an hour. So I'm trying to get, you know, sober. AA is like, I got contempt prior to investigation, like the big book says. I'm already there. I'm like, I'm not, AA, what the hell? That's not going to help me. So what happened to me is, and I've heard this before, the most dangerous drink there is, and I've heard this, and it's true, is O'Doul's. I started the O'Doul's program. You know how that went. All right, you're at the bar. This is me. I'm at the bar. I'm thinking, I can drink Old Duels. I have no clue about the alcohol in it. What you guys taught me when I got here about any alcohol, right? So I'm pounding these things down. I'm running to the men's room all the time. Like the doctor's opinion says, we drink for the effect. I'm not getting the effect you guys are getting drinking the Buds. So what am I do after 14 of these, right? What do I do with that bartender? Hey, how much is this Old Duels? Yeah, it's $1.50. Really? Well, how much is a Budweiser? It's $1.50. I'm telling you, that's just how simple it was for me. You know, and not till I got here did I learn about all the rationalization we do, all of that. And I think back, how the hell did I last with that kind of obsession? 14 bottles of Old Duels, you know, that was just the one night. I don't know how many nights I did that, thinking, you know, I got to be here with the party, drink like you guys are. So what happened to me was that Budweiser, within a week, I was drinking again in the morning. Within a week. Here it goes. So, for me, the houses, the wives, the businesses, the jobs, none of it. None of it mattered now. It's gone. It's all gone. I'm just drinking it away, going to the next drink, going to the next drink, losing it a little at a time, but I can't get out of it. I can't get out of that spiral. I keep going, and now, you know, finally I'm one bedroom, fully furnished, just surviving. And and the big book says this very well when it says, not until I read this with my sponsor did I understand it, that we come to that point where we're either going to accept the spiritual help or, I'm going to paraphrase, I guess, blot out what's going on in Rick's life and go on to the bitter end. And you know what? There were times I thought about that. You know, when the four horsemen were there in the morning and then I was taking the hair of the dog, I thought about that. I thought, screw this. I am. I'm going to go on. Screw this. And actually, 3 years ago, I buried a brother who did that. Who did that? No matter what I tried here, when I got sober and tried helping him, I was of no help. He just blotted out what was going on in his life, and I saw him maybe, I want to say 60 days before he passed, and I just, there was nothing I could do. But now here I am. And I mean, I had gotten to the point, you know, I'm in this one bedroom apartment. It's got those, I don't know if you've ever rented one of these, they got the long, I want to call them curtains hanging down, and I'm sitting there drinking to oblivion, and now I'm hallucinating. I am seeing these little guys run behind the curtain. They're about this tall. Just like I'm sitting here right now, I swear to you, I've been looking over there, and I would get up out of my chair And I would go over there and pull that curtain aside and look.
Did he run in the other way or something? Where did he?
And then I'd go sit back down and I would drink. And I got to this point where I said, I don't want to go on to the bitter end. I got really, you know, honest with myself. I don't know what. And this whole life that I have had from the beginning that I gave up is a God thing for me. I get so many God shots and so many insights that I look back now and say, what does he have planned for me? Oh my God, the things that I've done. And yet I keep getting these little subtle messages from my higher power anyway. So I'm like, that's it. I've got to do something. And somebody had given me a number of a facility. They had seen me and said, you need this place. And I call this place. And this woman's on the other end, and she's got one of the brochures with all the questions. And I don't remember how many they were. All right, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm wasted. And she says, you belong here. And I said, okay, I'll be right down. And she said, no, you can't come down. There's nobody to take you in right now. You'll have to come back, you know, or come in tomorrow. And I'm like, Jesus. And she goes, are you drinking right now? And I'm like, okay, let's get honest. Yes, I am. And she said, well, don't stop. And I thought, I like this place already. Don't stop. I'm like, Jesus, you're what I've been looking for. I didn't know why she said that at the time. You know, I do now. I know why she said it. But anyway, I trucked down there drunk the next day. And this is one of these places that takes your picture when they take you in, right? So you can see the before and the after. Right? Burn that thing, please. And day last of detox, I'll never forget. I was sitting across from the nurse's station, and it was a long hallway, and there was a door at the end of the hallway with the little window in it, and she, you know, beeped somebody in, buzzed them in, and snapped the door open. Somebody came walking down the hallway. And he got closer, and I'm looking at him, you know, because I'm not doing nothing. I'm just sitting there. And he's carrying something. And he gets closer, and I notice he's carrying a book. And he gets closer, I can read it. Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, oh, shit, they're here. I'm sitting in detox in my pajamas. What? Oh, shit, they're here. Who am I? And what you guys do, you gave me the book. And I thought, great, something to read while I'm here. A novel. And I read it like a novel while I was there. And the other thing that happened to me, which was very important, you know, there's a lot of things that happened to me that I can look back now, and this is where I say, you know, my higher power working for me, is that when I went from detox into the recovery center, that very first night when I slept, I dreamt, just like I'm standing here now and looking at you, that I did the very thing that I had always been doing for the last 5 years. I got a 12-pack of cans. It's in a paper bag. I set it on my kitchen counter, And just like, I don't know if you guys did this, but I didn't wait to put it in the fridge before I ripped the top off and grabbed the can out of there. And I did that in this dream, just like I'm standing here. And I popped the top, and I drank that sucker. And I went, oh, shit. What are you doing? What? Whoa, wait a minute. You went through all of this quitting and now you're drinking? What is going on? And boom, I woke myself up. And it was another one of those moments where I came to, there were many of these, where I'm on my back, I'm looking up going, where the hell did that ceiling come from? And I swear, that's what I did. I went, oh shit, did I do it again? And I looked over and I started looking around the room and I went, oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. I am in treatment. Holy crap, I didn't drink. But I had a knot the size of a softball right here. And that morning, when I got up, it was still there. And when I went out into group in the morning, they always had this little session. It asked, you know, how'd your night go or whatever? And I said, let me tell you. And I did. I told them the same thing I just said to you. And a woman, if I was sitting at 3 o'clock, she was sitting at 9 o'clock in the circle, and it was a counselor. And she said, I'll take that. She said, you can have withdrawal symptoms for up to 5 years, depending on, you know, how much you used or drank. And I was just like, whew. Because Rick could not stop. That is my problem. I can't stop. I stopped 3 times in one day one time. I can't stop. And I'm like, drinking already, and I'm in this treatment facility? I'm like, you're crazy. So I leave there, and what happens to me is, and I love this, you wouldn't have this speaker tonight if this hadn't happened, somebody from Bridging the Gap met me right in my driveway. Said, I am not even going to be your sponsor. He said, I'm going to take you to meetings for the next 2 weeks and introduce you to Alcoholics Anonymous in this area. And that's exactly what he did. Every night, we'd go to a different meeting. He would introduce me to people. They'd give me numbers and tell me about other meetings, that sort of thing. He saved my life. Because had I just been cast out on my own and said, you know, go to a meeting, it would have never happened. Here's what did happen. So they did, you know, this little analysis on Rick, and they said, we think, Rick, that you ought to go to aftercare for 6 months, 5 days a week. 3 of them are group therapy, 2 are individual therapy. We think you ought to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm like, okay, I do it. And and here's the deal for me, in my experience, there was desperation and there was obsession. And I'm fighting that damn thing all the time. I'm sitting in meetings and I'm thinking about drinking, but not knowing what the hell. You know, and I would say it in the groups I was in. I'm thinking about drinking right now. I'd tell them. And they would tell me, keep coming back. Don't drink between meetings. You're a winner. And, you know, I got sober in New York, and that's what they told me. And I used to think, Rick, did you make that up? And then I heard somebody from New York speak at one of the conferences, and he said that, and I went, damn, I did hear that. But what I didn't do is I didn't get a sponsor when I first got here. I'm 90 days in, at least. I'm at a meeting, And there's probably 40 people at this meeting. It's where all the tables are put together in a rectangle, right, shape. And Leo, my first sponsor, he is leading this meeting. And I'm pissed because I've been coming for 90 days. I'm not doing nothing. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing? But I'm still desperate enough to keep coming. This is my higher power working for me. So Leo says, does anybody have a topic? And now they had gone through and read everything, right? Including the promises. And I heard this thing in the promises, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And I went, I got a topic. I don't know shit. And I said, what the hell is this halfway through? What is halfway through? That's the topic. Tell me what it is. Leo is one of these guys that loves the big book. And Leo is one of these guys that he hears a knucklehead like me say something like that. He has a little notepad up front. And he writes you notes. And he wrote me one. I have kept this. So I say, I want the topic, what the hell is halfway through? Leo writes the note. I'm like, oh, shit, that's right, I forgot Leo's going to get me. So Leo writes this note. He writes, read the chapter into action, chapter 6 in the big book. Pay extra attention to pages 82 through 85. They are about halfway through. At the bottom he writes, halfway is where halfway is. See me after the meeting. Leo, thank God he collared me. Would become my sponsor and would introduce me to the big book, not as a novel, as Rick had, you know, read it, but rather how you interpret 164 pages, of which 82 through 84 is about halfway through. But all the way through. When Leo started taking me through the big book, that part in there where it talked about a spiritual program, a spiritual experience, remember where it's asterisk? And I'm like, oh, Leo, oh, give me the spiritual stuff. Ooh, spiritual. And he went, you know what, Rick? You're not so different. You think you are. But there's an appendix in the back that really talks to, you know, what you're saying right now about this spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. He said a lot of people had trouble with that when they first got here. As a matter of fact, it's an appendix. It's appended to what's in the big book. And I love this. This is the other thing that really saved my life. You know, the desperation saved my life, but doing this part of the book with Leo helped me because it really spelled out for me what the spiritual part of the program would be for me. And this is just this first paragraph got me. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Personality change sufficient enough to bring about recovery. Leo said, that's what you need, Rick. A personality change. And I said, what do you mean, Leo? What personality change? What's that? And he said, it's even, Rick, a little bit at a time. Like, please pass me the salt instead of, give me the goddamn salt, will you? Just a little bit at a time. And he's right. You know, that's what I needed. I needed that personality change in Rick's life, you know, instead of screaming out the window of the car, you know, doing something different. It's almost like do the opposite of what you were thinking of doing, Rick. So that you could have this spiritual experience. You know, working the steps, having a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. I continue today to have what I call spiritual experiences. I just love it. And it's defined a little bit in the big book by God consciousness, right? We have a God consciousness now. Where before, I would run around and go, see something happen. I go, oh, that's quite a coincidence there. I don't do that anymore. You know, I really look at it now and I go, oh my God, it's another one of those spiritual experiences. I moved around due to work, and I'll tell you about this one I had. I worked at Disney for a while in the technical field. Still do. I work in the technical field. And I was working at Disney, and I was a contractor. And at the time I was working at Disney, it's a good thing Janie's not here. She'd say, why the hell did you leave? Janie loves Disney. And I told her I worked there, and she was like, what? You left? But I left because of the money. We used to call it, they wanted to pay in sunshine dollars. That was a contractor term. But anyway, I still had my resume out there, and I got a call from a contractor. And so I went outside, and I took it on my cell phone, and I'm talking to this guy, and he goes, hey, I got a great position for you up in St. Louis. It's a brewery. I can't tell you their name, though. I'm like, he said, they're looking to put a whole new system in to automate the process of making beer, and you've got the experience they're looking for writing the code. And I'm like, really? You got a sense of humor. You know, just one of those spiritual experiences. I'm like, oh, well, who would ever think that? You know, my first day on the job there, they took me in the back room tour, right? And when they took me down into the cellar where those fermenters were all open, I was like, this is like being back in the bar the morning after. I'm like, oh my God, does it stink? But anybody else that was in there would be like, let me look in there. You know, it was like 17 or 18 of these things lined up. That at St. Louis, when I'm going to St. Louis. I'm on my way to St. Louis. I'm the good alcoholic. I packed all my worldly possessions in my car. I'm driving to St. Louis. And all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years sober. All this stuff is going through my brain. And I say, you know what? I better call my sponsor. This is crazy. I'm thinking all kinds of crazy stuff, you know. got a new job, heading to St. Louis. So I pull over in a rest area. Get on the cell phone, call my sponsor, blah, 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 blah. You wouldn't believe what's going on. He goes, where the hell are you? Now, he knows me, right? I said, I'm in a rest area. Oh, well, how are you calling me? I said, well, I got this cell phone. Oh, you got a cell phone! I'm like, oh, shit. He says, then where are you? I said, a rest area outside of Georgia, leaning against my car. Oh, you got a car! I'm like, oh, shit. So then he says, where are you going? I said, well, I got a new job. Oh, you got a job? And I'm like, now he's putting me, you know, right back, and I'm like, I got to go. I got to say, the one thing that saved my butt through all of this was Leo, when I first got him as a sponsor. I don't know about you. My experience was the last 3 or 4 years that I drank, I didn't want to be around anybody. Drink, pass out. I don't want to go to a bar or anything. I wish the hell they had delivered to me, you know, that I didn't have to go out. Leo, you know, and telling him the way my life was, Leo had just the job for me at my new home group. Get out there and greet people as they come in. I'm like, oh, no, I got to stick my hand out. Yes, I want you to welcome everybody that's coming. And that was the start, you know, of service for me. And service has saved my life. In my home group, when I was in St. Louis, we did the treatment facilities, we did the prisons, the jails, the just anything. Our newsletter each month had a list of all the 12-step calls that we were going to do. When I moved from St. Louis to here, to Georgia, I said, I am not living my life in my car anymore driving to work. I'm going to put the bullseye on my job, and then I'm going to find a place right close to that. And when I was in St. Louis, my home group was near the inner city, and a lot of the work we did was in the inner city. And where I'm at now, I'm not. And when I was in my first home group, I just felt this restlessness all the time. I was like, what the hell is the matter with you? And I don't know what's the matter with me. I'm not doing anything. I wasn't doing any service work. And I went to my zone, sat in the zone meeting, and at the end of the zone meeting, they said, we need a corrections rep. Who would like to be? I'm the only new guy there. Who would like to be the corrections rep? And I said, I'll do it. And I started here with, and in my zone, with corrections work, going up to Phillips State Prison, taking a meeting up there, coming down here and joining the meetings with the corrections committee. Worked the corrections committee at the metro level. And I got to say, some of the moments that I've had up at Phillips State Prison are absolutely God shots. I had one. Oh, man, this is funny. There was a guy getting out, and Jim Turner told me, you know, you got to fill out this paperwork when these guys are leaving, send it in, and we'll have somebody meet them and take them to a meeting, that sort of thing. And this guy was leaving like next week or 2 weeks. So I said, oh, geez, give me some information here. Where are you going? Blah, blah, blah. So I said, maybe we'll get you to a meeting right away. This is Thursday. The following Monday, I get a call from his counselor. She goes, I got inmate so-and-so here, and he says you're going to get him a job and a place to live. And blah, blah. I'm like, no. And she goes, no, I didn't think so. So I said what I told him is, you know, we try to get him a meeting. And I said, send him to the meeting this Thursday. So he comes to the meeting on Thursday. I said, hey, we didn't tell you we're going to give you a place to live and blah, blah, blah. He goes, I know. He says, I'm getting out. I'm going to Chattanooga. He's not even coming into Georgia. He's going to Chattanooga. And he says, I'm going to the homeless shelter there. I went, oh, Jesus. So he gives me this slip of paper, and there's a telephone number and a name on it. And you're not supposed to do this, but he says, this is my old sponsor. He said, would you call him and tell him I'm going to be at that facility on Main Street in Chattanooga, the homeless shelter? And I said, oh, Rick, you probably shouldn't do this, but I can't see this guy go like that. So anyway, I get home. The next day, I call this guy. So he answers the phone. I tell him who I am. I say, we got an inmate coming out to Chattanooga. He, you know, told him the guy's name. And I said, he gave me your number. And I said, he's going to a homeless shelter on Main Street in Chattanooga. And he goes, no, he's not. And I said, what? He said, I am the former chair of corrections for the state of Tennessee. And he said, I know that guy. And he said, that's the last place we want that guy to go. He said, I'll be there to pick him up. I'll take care of him. And I was just like, I can't believe this. You've done it again. And just things like that that keep happening all the time to me. They're just these great God shots for me, these spiritual experiences. I had another one where we're sitting in a meeting. We open the meeting, and we always, these guys would say it, and it was not my meeting, it's theirs. They'd say, does anybody have a burning desire before we start? And there was a guy kind of standing behind us at the table, and he's just hanging back there. I never saw him at the meeting, but he stepped right up and he said, if you mean, do I have something I need to say right now, can I say something? And the guys all said, yeah, sure. He said, 7 years ago, he said, I was drunk driving my pickup, and he said, I hit a guy and killed him. He said, we just went in front of the judge the other day. He said, my whole family came down, my kids, my wife, my mother, my father, it all came down in front of the judge, asked him if I could get my sentence reduced so I could get out. And he said, the judge said no. And he said, with everybody there and all the circumstances, he said, what I've been through, he said, the first thing I thought about was drinking. I want to drink right now. He said, I've been here 7 years, and I have not had a drink. He said, but I wanted a drink right then. And he said, with my family there, everything. He said, I really need this. And I said, well, I had been bringing a Spanish big book with me up there all the time. And we never get any Spanish-speaking people there, ever. So I quit bringing it. But I said to him, I said, well, I've got an English-speaking one here, you know, in my bag. And I said, I'll let you have that. And I reached into my bag, and I handed it over to him. And he looked at me and he said, this is Spanish. And I said, really? He said, yeah, it's Spanish. I don't ever remember putting that in my bag, grabbing it, nothing. It's just another one of those God shots. Anyway, that's just the way service has been for me. I mean, I went from the corrections to, they asked me if I'd stand for alternate DCM and then for DCM. And I said yes, and it's just been fantastic for me ever since. On the 2015 International, I'm a part of that with the topic meetings, chairing that. And I was at a meeting with GSO the other day, and Eva, who's really heading up this whole convention for Georgia, said something that I know she just said it innocently, but I thought about it after she said it, and it really sums it up for me, and I'll close on this. She said, it's amazing when we give how much we get back. It's amazing when we give how much we get back, and that is so true for me today. That, to me, is why I keep coming back. Thanks.